Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 486, looking back at the Kennedy assassination. This is being recorded on November 21st of the year 2004. Before we get into our discussion of the assassination of President Kennedy, this on what is approximately the 41st anniversary of his killing, let me remind you that there is a CD duplication service called Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They are located at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California. That's capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D. That's in, of course, California, zip code 95005. You can reach them by email at mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. Spitfirelist is one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E-L-I-S-T.com. And there is a website, www.spitfirelist.com, that has what is quite literally a wealth of material. In the first place, each For the Record program has a long, written, detailed, annotated description available in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. Frequently, there is information included in the descriptions that, due to the limitations of time, I did not or was not able to include in the original broadcast. Those of you who are only using the broadcast or only listening to the on-air material or the audio files made available by Spitfire and also, but particularly, by sister station WFMU, about which I will tell you in a minute, those of you who are only using the audio portion are missing a tremendous amount of the resource. So please do get in the habit of using the printed material on the Spitfire website. In addition to the descriptions of the For the Record shows, there are also descriptions of the other programs and lectures that are available from Spitfire. And also there is the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, available for download. That's a pivotally important book, a suppressed book, and it is essential for an understanding of the material that I present here. It is now available for download on the internet for free. Again, there is a section at www.spitfirelist.com. There's also a link to a website maintained by some listeners in the Midwest that has the declassified U.S. government documents about the Bush family's involvement with Nazi industry before, during, and after World War II. And last, but most assuredly not least, as I alluded to earlier, sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, the heroic WFMU-FM, is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word, D-A-V-E-E-M-O-R-Y. Older programs are available for download only, also on Real Audio at a longer URL, linked to both that address and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. The latest pair of half-hour segments are available for download only on Real Audio at www.spitfirelist.com for approximately a week or so after they have been recorded. Now, as veteran listeners are no doubt aware, one of the fundaments of my work for more than a quarter of a century now has been America's political assassinations, and in particular, the assassination of President Kennedy. This is November 21st of 2004. It is roughly the 41st anniversary of that event. Also, the fall of 2004 is the 40th anniversary of the release of the Warren Report. The Warren Commission was a presidential fact-finding commission ostensibly charged with investigating President Kennedy's assassination, but as knowledgeable researchers are aware of, in fact, the Warren Commission was covering up the assassination for purposes of PR and for maintaining the dignity of the United States. The Warren Report, as discussed in many archive shows and also in many For the Record shows that are available, is pure fiction. And what we're going to do for the first part of the program is to examine an article that was published this past September in Salon.com. This article is called The Mother of All Cover-Ups and is subheaded, 40 years after the Warren Report, the official verdict on the Kennedy assassination, we now know the country's high and mighty were secretly among its biggest critics. This is authored by David Talbot, T-A-L-B-O-T. It was published in Salon.com on September 15th of the year 2004. And after noting that we had had a number of official reports on events that had been published recently, the 9/11 report, the Senate Intelligence Committee report about September 11th, and also the Schlesinger report about the Abu Ghraib prison scandal, author David Talbot notes that in light of this, it is appropriate to examine the first official, quote, report, unquote. It was actually a cover-up. And as he makes very clear here, and as we're going to examine in detail, many of the most powerful people in this country, including many of those who were involved to one extent or another with President Kennedy's administration or with the administration of officialdom after President Kennedy's death, did not believe the Warren Report. Among the people who didn't were President Johnson, Robert Kennedy, President Kennedy's brother and the Attorney General, later assassinated himself as a result of a conspiracy hatched by the same elements. Richard Nixon didn't believe it. His aide, Robert Haldeman, didn't believe it. Charles de Gaulle didn't believe it. Khrushchev, the Prime Minister of the Soviet Union, didn't believe it. We're going to examine how Robert Kennedy appeared to be keeping close tabs on Jim Garrison's investigation in New Orleans and was apparently supportive of that. Kennedy aide Kenneth O'Donnell didn't believe the Warren Report. J. Edgar Hoover didn't believe the Warren Report. Apparently, there were a great many other people involved. George H.W. Bush, when he was head of the CIA, supposedly wasn't interested in the Kennedy assassination. In fact, he requisitioned a number of aspects of the agency's files. As we've seen in many broadcasts, including some miscellaneous archive shows, George H.W. Bush's name crops up in connection with the Kennedy assassination in many ways. Perhaps most notably, he was director of the CIA for a key year after the House Select Committee on Assassinations was formed and was less than vigorous in his cooperation with that committee. In the mid-1970s, when congressional committees, notably the Senate Church Committee, were investigating CIA misdeeds, a couple of those senators, in particular Gary Hart from Colorado and Richard Schweiker from Connecticut, were deeply involved in Church Committee's investigation, and both had concluded that the Kennedy assassination should be reopened because the Warren Report was false and a travesty. We're going to take a look at this official, although off-the-record, departure from assent to the Warren Commission's verdict right now. Again, from Salon.com, September 15th, 2004, article by David Talbot, "The Mother of All Cover-Ups," skipping down. So it's only appropriate, in this stormy season of the official version and its discontents, that we observe the 40th anniversary of the Warren Report, the mother of all such controversies. The vast 26-volume report was delivered by the Commission Chairman, Chief Justice Earl Warren, to President Johnson on September 24, 1964. The Warren Report concluded that Kennedy was the victim of a lone, unstable assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald, who was himself conveniently gunned down just 2 days later in the Dallas police station by mob-connected hustler Jack Ruby. The Warren Commission, itself the victim of massive fraud and manipulation by the FBI and CIA, came under immediate fire from critics, with its report being denounced as a government cover-up by a growing army of independent researchers. History has not been any kinder to the Warren Report, which has been derided and condemned by everyone from the House Select Committee on Assassinations, the only other federal panel to exhaustively probe Kennedy's murder, and which found in 1979 that the president was the probable target of a conspiracy, to Oliver Stone in his explosive 1991 film JFK, to the History Channel, which routinely airs even the outer limits of conspiracy theories. 4 decades later, the Warren Report is widely regarded as a whitewash, with polls consistently showing that a majority of Americans reject the official version of Kennedy's death. But there is one sanctuary where the Warren Report is still stubbornly upheld, and where its manifold critics can expect their own rough treatment in the towers of the media elite. Fresh from assaulting Oliver Stone, not only for his film, but for his very character, a media shark attack in which I must confess I too once engaged, the national press rushed to embrace Gerald Posner's bold 1993 defense of the Warren Report, case closed, making it a bestseller. Quote, "The most convincing explanation of the assassination," unquote, historian Robert Dalek called it in the Boston Globe. Interrupting parenthetically, case closed for younger listeners or newer listeners, is basically a tissue of lies. It is valuable only to horticulturalists and would make excellent fertilizer if properly applied. Continuing. And the 40th anniversary of JFK's murder last November sparked a new fusillade of anti-conspiracy sound and fury, with ABC's Peter Jennings making yet another network news attempt to silence the report's critics. Most of the press lords and pundits in the 1960s who allowed themselves to be convinced that the Warren Report was the correct version of what happened in Dallas, whether because they genuinely believed it or because they thought it was good for the good of the country, are now dead or retired. But after buying the official version for so long, it seems the elite media institutions have too much invested in the Warren Report to change their minds now, even if they're under new editorial leadership. One of the great ironies of history is that while the media elite was busily trying to shore up public confidence in the Warren Report, the political elites were privately confiding among themselves that the report was a travesty, a fairy tale for mass consumption. Presidents, White House aides, intelligence officials, senators, congressmen, even foreign leaders, they all muttered darkly among themselves that Kennedy was killed by a conspiracy, a plot that a number of them suspected had roots in the U.S. government itself. In truth, some high media dignitaries have also quietly shared their doubts about the official version. In 1993, CBS anchorman Dan Rather, who did much along with his network to enforce the party line on Dallas, confessed to Robert Tannenbaum, the former deputy chief counsel of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, quote, "We really blew it on the Kennedy assassination," unquote. Next, LBJ's disbelief in the Warren Report. Thanks to tapes of White House conversations that have been released to the public in recent years, we now know that the man who appointed the Warren Commission, President Lyndon Johnson, did not believe its conclusions. On September 18, 1964, the last day the panel met, Commission member Senator Richard Russell phoned Johnson, his old political protege, to tell him he did not believe the single bullet theory, the key to the Commission's finding that Oswald acted alone. "I don't either," unquote, Johnson told him. Johnson's theories about what really happened in Dallas shifted over the years. Soon after the assassination, Johnson was led to believe by the CIA that Kennedy might have been the victim of a Soviet conspiracy. Later, his suspicions focused on Castro. During his long-running feud with Robert Kennedy, LBJ leaked a story to Washington columnist Drew Pearson suggesting the Kennedy brothers themselves were responsible for JFK's death by triggering a violent reaction from the Cuban leader with their, quote, "Goddamn Murder Incorporated," unquote, plots to kill him. In 1967, according to a report in the Washington Post, Johnson's suspicious gaze came to rest on the CIA. The newspaper quoted White House aide Marvin Watson as saying that Johnson was now convinced, unquote, Kennedy was the victim of a plot, and, again quoting, that the CIA had something to do with this plot, unquote. Max Holland, who has just published a study of LBJ's views on Dallas, the Kennedy assassination tapes, intriguingly concludes that Johnson remained haunted by the murder throughout his tenure in the White House. Quote, "It's virtually an article of faith among historians that the war in Vietnam was the overwhelming reason the president left office in 1969, a worn, bitter, and disillusioned man," writes Holland, again quoting, "Yet the assassination-related tapes paint a more nuanced portrait, one in which Johnson's view of the assassination weighed as heavily on him as did the war," unquote. Next, author Talbot discusses Robert Kennedy's skepticism about the official version of his brother's murder, and also significant indications that he was going to reopen his brother's murder after he got elected president. Of course, that never happened because he was assassinated on the evening on which he had won the California primary, assuring him of the Democratic nomination. Had he then lived, he would have faced Richard Nixon in 1968, the man who was defeated by his brother, and Nixon's name crops up in connection with the assassination. In many ways, Nixon was in Dallas, Texas on November 22, 1963. He flew out about an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours before Kennedy was killed. Yet when interviewed by the FBI in February of 1964, Nixon told them, quote, that the only time, he told them that the only time he was in Dallas, Texas in 1963 was, quote, 2 days before the assassination, unquote. That's a readily verifiable lie. The New York Times and San Francisco Chronicle, among other papers, had interviews with Nixon in Dallas, Texas on November 21st, a day after he said he had left. Continuing, of Robert Kennedy's skepticism about the assassination, critics of the Warren Report's lone assassination conclusion were often stumped by defenders of the report with the question, quote, if there was a conspiracy, why didn't President Kennedy's own brother, the Attorney General of the United States, Robert Kennedy, do anything about it, unquote. It's true that at least until shortly before his assassination in June of 1968, Bobby Kennedy publicly supported the Warren Report. On March 25th, during a presidential rally at San Fernando Valley State College in California, Kennedy was dramatically confronted by a woman heckler who called out, quote, we want to know who killed President Kennedy, unquote. Kennedy responded by saying, quote, I stand by the Warren Commission report, unquote. But a later campaign appearance, days before his assassination, Bobby Kennedy said the opposite, according to former press spokesman Frank Mankiewicz. When asked if he would reopen the investigation into his brother's death, he uttered a simple one-word answer, yes. Mankiewicz recalls today, I remember that I was stunned by the answer. It was either like he was suddenly blurting out the truth, or it was a way to shut down the questioning, you know, yes, now let's move on, unquote. His public statements on the Warren Report were obviously freighted with political and emotional and perhaps even security concerns for Bobby Kennedy. But we have no doubt what his private opinion of the report was. As his biographer Evan Thomas wrote, Kennedy, quote, regarded the Warren Commission as a public relations exercise to reassure the public, unquote. According to a variety of reports, Kennedy suspected a plot as soon as he heard his brother had been shot in Dallas. And as he made calls and inquiries in the hours and days before the assassination, he came to an ominous conclusion. JFK was the victim of a domestic political conspiracy. In a remarkable passage in One Hell of a Gamble, a widely praised 1997 history of the Cuban Missile Crisis based on declassified Soviet and U.S. government documents, historians Alexander Forsenko and Timothy Naftali wrote that on November 29th, 1 week after the assassination, Bobby Kennedy dispatched a close family friend named William Walton to Moscow with a remarkable message for Georgi Bolshakov, the KGB agent he had come to trust during the nerve-wracking, back-channel discussions sparked by the missile crisis. According to the historians, Walton told Bolshakov that Bobby and Jacqueline Kennedy believed, quote, there was a large political conspiracy behind Oswald's rifle, unquote, and again quoting, that Dallas was the ideal location for such a crime, unquote. The Kennedys also sought to reassure the Soviets that despite Oswald's apparent connections to the communist world, they believed President Kennedy had been killed by American enemies. This is a stunning account, with the fallen president's brother and widow communicating their chilling suspicions to the preeminent world rival of the U.S., and it has not received nearly the public attention it deserves. Both Khrushchev, who had been working with JFK to ease tensions between the superpowers, and his chief shared Kennedy's dark view of the assassination. KGB chairman reacted incredulously to the news that Oswald, A man whom his agency had closely monitored after he defected to the Soviet Union was the culprit. Quote, I thought that this man could not possibly be the mastermind of the crime, unquote. And, according to Prosenko and Naftali, again quoting, intelligence coming to Khrushchev in the weeks following the assassination seemed to confirm the theory that a right-wing conspiracy had killed Kennedy, unquote. This assessment was shared by the governments of Cuba, Mexico, and France, where President de Gaulle, when briefed by a reporter on the lone nut theory, reacted with Gallic skepticism, laughing, Vous me blaguez, you're kidding me, cowboys and Indians, unquote. In the years after his brother's death, Bobby Kennedy was overwhelmed by grief. But the common perception that he found it too painful to focus on the assassination is belied by the fact that Kennedy maintained a searching curiosity about critics of the Warren Report, using surrogates like Mankiewicz, Walter Sheridan, Ed Guthman, and John Siegenthaler to check out their work, and dispatching his former aides to New Orleans to evaluate Jim Garrison's investigation. In fact, Kennedy himself phoned New Orleans coroner Nicholas Chetta at his home after the death of key Garrison suspect David Ferry to question Chetta about his report. And while Sheridan, a trusted friend of Kennedy's who had worked closely with him on his Jimmy Hoffa investigation, famously repudiated Garrison in a 1967 documentary for NBC, RFK apparently still kept ties to the Garrison camp. According to William Turner, a former FBI agent who worked as a Garrison investigator during the Kennedy case, in April of 1968, he received a call in the New Orleans prosecutor's office from an RFK campaign aide named Richard Lubick. Quote, he said, Bill, Bobby's going to go. He's going to reopen the investigation after he wins, unquote. I went in immediately and told Jim Garrison. He didn't seem surprised, unquote. Bobby was not the only member of President Kennedy's inner circle who believed there was a conspiracy. Presidential aides Kenny O'Donnell and Dave Powers, key members of JFK's, quote, Irish Mafia, unquote, were in a trailing limousine in the Dallas motorcade. Both of them later told House Speaker Tip O'Neill that they heard two shots from behind the fence on the grassy knoll. Quote, that's not what you told the Warren Commission, a stunned O'Neill replied, according to his 1989 memoir, Man of the House. You're right, O'Donnell said. I told the FBI what I had heard, but they said it couldn't have happened that way and that I must have been imagining things, unquote. So not wanting, quote, to stir up more pain and trouble for the family, unquote, O'Donnell told the commission what the FBI wanted him to. Speaking of the FBI, its deeply sinister strongman J. Edgar Hoover might have lied his eyes out, unquote, to the Warren Commission, as panel member Hale Boggs, a Louisiana congressman, memorably told an aide pressuring and maneuvering the commission to reach a lone assassin verdict. But again, in private, Hoover told another story. The summer after the assassination, Hoover was relaxing at the Del Charro Resort in California, which was owned by his friend, right-wing Texas oil tycoon Clint Murchison. Another Texas oil crony of Hoover's, Billy Byers Sr., the only man Hoover had called on the afternoon of November 22, 1963, besides Robert Kennedy and the head of the Secret Service, also was present. At one point, according to Anthony Summers, the invaluable prober of the dark side of American power, Byers' teenage son, Billy Jr., got up his nerve to ask Hoover the question, do you think Lee Harvey Oswald did it, unquote? According to Byers, Hoover stopped and looked at me for quite a long time. Then he said, if I told you what I really know, it would be very dangerous for this country. Our whole political system could be disrupted, unquote. Blunt skepticism about the Warren Report was a bipartisan affair, with leaders on both sides of the aisle airily dismissing its conclusions. On a White House tape recording, President Nixon is heard telling aides that the Warren Report, quote, was the greatest hoax that has ever been perpetuated, unquote. One of Nixon's top aides, White House Chief of Staff H.R. Bob Haldeman, shared his boss's skepticism. In his 1978 memoir, The Ends of Power, Haldeman, who, quote, had always been intrigued with the conflicting theories of the assassination, unquote, recalls that when the Nixon team moved into the White House in 1969, he felt that they finally, quote, would be in a position to get all the facts, unquote. But Nixon, perhaps wary of where all those facts would lead, rejected Haldeman's suggestion. According to Haldeman, Nixon did play the assassination card in a mysterious way against CIA Director Richard Helms, long regarded by Warren Report critics to have some connection to the gunshots in Dallas. Seeking to pressure the CIA into helping him out of his Watergate mess, Nixon had Haldeman deliver this cryptic message, apparently a threat to Helms. Quote, "The president asked me to tell you this entire Watergate affair may be connected to the Bay of Pigs, and if it opens up, the Bay of Pigs may be blown," unquote. This prompted an explosive reaction from the spymaster. Quote, "Turmoil in the room. Helms gripping the arms of his chair, leaning forward and shouting, 'The Bay of Pigs had nothing to do with this. I have no concern about the Bay of Pigs,'" unquote. Haldeman speculates that the Bay of Pigs may have been Nixon's code for something related to the CIA, Castro, and the Kennedy assassination. But whatever dark card Nixon played, it worked. Haldeman reported back to his boss that the CIA director was now very happy to be helpful, unquote. Nixon was not willing to publicly reopen the box of assassination demons, but many of them began flying out when the Church Committee started investigating CIA abuses in the 1970s, including the unholy pact between the agency and the mafia to eliminate Fidel Castro. The bombshell headlines produced by the Church Committee would, in fact, lead to the formation of the House Select Committee on Assassinations in 1977. Among those in Washington who were particularly curious about the revelations concerning the CIA and the Kennedy assassination was George H.W. Bush. As Kitty Kelly observes in her new book about the Bush family, while serving as the CIA director in the Ford administration, Bush fired off a series of memos in the fall of 1976 asking subordinates various questions about Oswald, Ruby, Helms, and other figures tied to the assassination. Quote, "Years later, when Bush became President of the United States, he would deny making any attempt to review the agency files on the JFK assassination," unquote, writes Kelly in The Family, The Real Story of the Bush Dynasty, unquote. When he made this claim, he did not realize that the agency would release 18 documents under the Freedom of Information Act that showed he had indeed, as CIA director, requested information not once, but several times, on a wide range of questions surrounding the Kennedy assassination, unquote. And as indicated, Bush's name crops up in connection with the actual act in a number of contexts. We'll continue with this article on the next side of this program, but this concludes side one of For the Record program number 486, looking back at the Kennedy assassination. This is being recorded on November 21st of the year 2004. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.